Hi, everyone. It's Ryan Hoover, your host of Product Hunt Radio, where I'm joined by the founders, investors, and makers that are shaping the future of tech. Today, we have two notable investors on the show, Alexia and Nico Bonotsos, who have gotten to know over the years since building and starting Product Hunt. Alexia was the former co-editor at TechCrunch, where she covered everything tech, including some articles about the early days of Product Hunt. Like many other former TechCrunch reporters, she has since transitioned her career into venture, starting her own fund called Dream Machine, with the goal of investing in founders who turn science fiction into nonfiction. Her husband and longtime investor, Nico, is the managing director at General Catalyst, a Silicon Valley-based firm with investments in a few companies you might recognize: Airbnb, ClassPass, Snap, Gusto, Warby Parker, and a few others. On the show, we discuss opportunities within the nascent wide world of audio and voice, how the VC ecosystem has changed as new investors have entered the scene, and we share a few of our favorite products that you may not have heard of. But before I jump in, I want to give a shout out to our sponsors. We're happy to have Intercom as a sponsor of the show, a tool we've used at Product Hunt since the beginning. Once upon a time, when Product Hunt first started, I would monitor our Intercom dashboard to see who was signing up and visiting the site in real time. It was super fun to see the diversity of people across the world joining every single day. As people signed up, I reached out one by one, introducing myself in hopes to create a memorable first impression. Intercom made this easy to do with its in-app messaging, and while this isn't the most scalable strategy, people responded very positively. It helped really create a memorable impression and helped build that early community. Today, we use Intercom at a much bigger scale, answering questions and reaching out to people for feedback as we're building and launching new features. So if you're building a community or really any product with users, you can do this too. Check out intercom.com. We'd like to thank Airtable for making the show possible. I've been speaking with a diverse mix of companies that use Airtable to build their business, including Austin Allred, co-founder of Lambda School.
Tell me more about Lambda School. What are you doing there?
We train people to be software engineers and data scientists in live online classes. But we do it for free in exchange for a share of people's future income for a couple of years. The goal is to get access to world-class education to everybody.
If you were to choose one word to describe Airtable, what would that word be?
Oh man, I would say fun.
You usually don't hear people describe anything that resembles a spreadsheet as fun.
Definitely not. I honestly wonder if sometimes people don't realize how incredible the tech under the hood must be to make all this work. I mean, it's astounding that you just have a database that loads in the cloud seamlessly and quickly. That engineering team should win awards. It's pretty incredible.
You can get $50 off Airtable by visiting airtable.com/producthunt. Hey, everybody. This is Ryan Hoover. I'm at General Catalyst chatting with Nico and Alexia. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well. Alexia, I have to address what people can't see is you have a back brace.
Yes, I am being embraced by a brace. I'm embraced. Yes, I have a fractured vertebrae. So it's making it a little bit hard, but you know, I'm up to the challenge. I want to live, so I'm doing everything in my capacity to do so, including wearing this beautiful piece of hardware.
It's beautiful. Yes.
I would actually say that Alexia now is
augmented.
And she could evaluate exoskeleton companies in a proper way. So anybody who is helping us become bionic human beings, maybe it should be reaching out to Alexia.
It's Alexia at dreammachine.vc.
Yeah, if you have any bionic machines to pitch Alexia, if you're fundraising.
Exoskeletons, yeah. Any bio, just any bio.
Yeah. Let's quickly jump into Dream Machine, because you just relatively new fund that you started.
Yes.
How long has it been since you closed or
raised? We started investing in January of this year. Done 10 investments. I've done 10 investments so far. I'm of your generation of micro funds that are solo GPs. So it's me, you, it's Neve, it's a CC Boom. There's a bunch of us, and we're all around the same age, and we all started our funds around the same time. I think we're in a strange transition period from one innovation wave to another. So I like exceptions. I like things that are weird. It's an opportunistic fund. Really excited about frontier tech because eventually the future will be now, and all of these crazy science fiction things that we read about will be tools that we use and that we love.
Hence the name Dream Machine.
Hence the name Dream Machine. We help companies tell their story. We make science fiction nonfiction.
It's a good tagline. And then, Nico, you've been, how long have you been at General Catalyst? A while.
Been here for 8 years, so approaching dinosaur status now.
Wow.
But it took me a number of years to climb through the ranks. It's a GP 3 years now, almost.
Yeah, nice. And yeah, I think we met, I don't remember when, but before you were officially a GP, I think.
We met right before you were starting Product Hunt.
Yeah.
It was like still, I remember like a mailing list.
Oh, yeah. So that was really,
like
early days.
Really, really interesting. Like I could see, you know, the magic that you are amazing at creating and growing communities. There's like obvious, you know, something you care deeply about from back.
You're also amazing at recommending good products. Like your company is very authentic to you. It's almost as if Ryan Hoover scaled. Like if you actually found a way to make your special talent of like nudging people and being like, hey, check this out. Hey, check this out into a massive platform. So
yeah. Well, I swear I didn't tell them to say those things, but I have described Product Hunt as like, for better or worse, like sort of me if I was a product, and that, yeah, I just love products. I love talking to founders. I love exploring this future sci-fi kind of future. And that's partly what the podcast is for, is like, let's talk about this crazy tech and cool ideas. And most of these things are not going to work out, but that's the whole point. Like some of them will, and they'll change the way that we communicate or live or work and all these other things. So
absolutely. And back to your earlier point, you know, the bar is pretty low. If you're one of these people who actually tries a bunch of stuff and you have a point of view as a user, before you meet with the founder who built them, can make a big difference. Like you can be an informed potential investor. Bar is really low nowadays.
Why is the bar so low?
Because there's so much going on. People don't have time. Often over time, you think you know everything and it's just another meeting and you may not pay attention.
A good investor. Oh, interesting.
Not necessarily. A good investor is like, you know, like a big statement to make, but somebody who genuinely cares about the meeting with the founder that they're going to have as an investor, you know.
This is something that a lot of people are interested in, is becoming an investor and starting your own fund or at least dabbling in this space. Let's talk a little bit about the venture ecosystem a little bit. Like how have you seen it change, Nico, as you've been, you know, formally investing for several years, almost a decade now?
Yeah, it's changed a lot. So a few things have happened in this low interest rate environment and in a world where everybody has seen that the most valuable companies on the planet are tech companies and tech startups can grow really, really quickly. What happened is a lot of capital has tried to get into the tech world, often by virtue of investing in the VC funds that are investing in tech startups. So there's a lot more capital than ever before that is chasing after now fewer potentially, you know, like fast growing opportunity. Because as Alexei mentioned before, you know, we're in this, you know, weird time that it's like the San Francisco weather. It's like foggy.
Yeah.
Like when I got started in the industry, 2010, you know, mobile was clear. It would work out. SaaS and cloud was clear. It would work out. Now we have a number of emerging platforms, crypto, AR, AI, which is not really a platform, and a bunch of other things, you know, going on, but it's not, you know, like clear. But hey, you know, this is an industry based on exceptions. So eventually, you know, for those lucky few, things will work out handsomely. So what has changed in the ecosystem? A lot more funds. Most of us have a lot more capital than before. The seed ecosystem has changed dramatically. You have a couple of leading accelerators that are now becoming, some of them, you know, a bit later stage. You have three versions of seed, pre-seed, seed, seed two.
Seed prime.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that a saying? Is that a term people use?
Yeah, there's a whole fund around seed
prime.
It is. It's called bullpen capital.
Oh, okay.
The post-seed, because entrepreneurs have figured out that if you don't call it an A, then you don't have to show that people want to use what you're building.
Yeah, but effectively, a lot of these folks, you know, have become the early stage investors now, because if you're somebody who comes into a business as a pre-seed investor and then you double down and triple down in the following two, well, you have like 25% ownership of a company. it was not a Series A done at once, but it was basically a tranche Series A, which is how venture used to be a number of years ago. And then companies can stay private for much longer.
Or go back to private.
Elon announced recently.
Yeah, so all these things have
changed. The tweet was not a joke.
No, it wasn't.
What areas of technology in terms of industries or spaces, you mentioned things like AR, and we've been talking a lot about voice, Alexia. What areas are you excited to explore as an investor?
Yeah, well, voice. because of this really simple reason, you're probably listening to this on some sort of headphones or AirPods. And at this moment, me, Ryan, and Nico are in your ear. We are very, very much a part of you at the moment. And I think that could have incredible impact beyond the podcasting use case. I think it could apply to chat. It could apply to human computer interfaces. Like, I still get a thrill every time I tell my lights to turn on and they turn on. It turns me on in the most PG-13 way. But I think there's much to be said for moving away from a screen and moving away from the kind of hunched over your phone mode of computing. And I think voice is the first huge step towards that. And so I've invested in two voice companies so far. Both of them I don't think I can talk about, but ironically.
Yeah, I know. Not yet.
To add on what Alexia just said, Daniel Ek had an interesting saying
a few months from Spotify.
Yeah. So we heard him on Code say that if there's so many, you know, like $100 billion plus of market cap that have been created based on screen time, mm-hmm. like, you know, if you combine the values or the market caps of, you know, Snap and Instagram and YouTube and all these folks. Mm-hmm. And he was like, clearly, you know, people value folks' attention, visual attention quite a bit. And he said, well, you know, but your ears are equally, you know, are equally valuable. The question is, you know, how much, you know, valuable they are if compared to your eyes. So he's like, is it like, you know, 10%, 2%, 20%? You decide. And this
pictures
was the...
Pictures worth 1,000 words. So,
so audio 0.1%. Is... Yeah.
Yeah, it could be that. So basically, you know, he was making the case that audio is dramatically undervalued and it has a lot of upside to make. And this is what he's, you know, fighting for.
Yeah.
And the other beautiful thing about audio is that it doesn't need to be synchronous, right? Historically, the radio industry has thrived because people also can passively listen to radio while, you know, studying, working, commuting.
Yeah.
So while you have to watch a YouTube video or Instagram post and have almost undivided attention, you could be on audio for like 8 hours a day.
Yeah. There's some people that I know, one person in particular I won't name maybe, is she listens to podcasts all day while she's working, and she'll churn through 6-8 hours of podcasts in a day. And, you know, I think there's people that start to wear AirPods or other similar devices 24/7. Now you basically have a window, or I don't know, window is not the right word, because what's the word?
Audience.
A megaphone
in people's ears. At the end of the day, too, audio is just another form of interacting with technology, and it's like a vehicle to communicate or consume information, and it's really underutilized. Like, oh, podcasting is the closest thing, I would say, to, like, and radio before that, of course, to technology influencing, you know, people, the things people hear.
Of course. Yeah.
I think as increasingly people are using apps like Moment and are paying attention to movements like the time well spent. Mm-hmm. And so if they are cognizant of the fact that they've spent 5 hours on your screen, getting that Moment notification that tells me that I spent 3 or 4 or 5 hours of my precious time on this earth using Instagram is pretty depressing. And so anything that kind of weans you off of that, for me, is a good thing. And I think voice is part of that weaning.
Yeah, the other aspect of it is that it's much more natural in many ways. You know, we're not built, you know, to hunch over a small screen for so many hours. We're not built to tap on touch screens for so many hours. It has issues, you know, with your back and other things that I can talk about as I'm getting older. But you know, with audio, it's much more natural. Like the UI, you know, it's not UI. You know, the
yeah. What,
the
what UX is it called? Is
really cool. UI-less.
Yeah.
UVX.
Direct
I don't
to
know.
Consumer.
Yeah.
Direct D to E. Direct to ear.
Remember when the iPhone, iPod, and iPads came out, and a lot of my friends or coworkers have babies, and I just noticed them playing with touchpads in a way that was very natural for them. And they started then, of course, going to TVs and starting to like rub their greasy hands all over the TVs and like, hey, you know, Bobby, it's not a touchscreen. You can't do that. But they grew up with this expectation that touchscreens and like a way of interacting with technology is this is how you do it. And I'm curious to see in the future when we do have these audio devices that start to consume more of our kind of the way that we interact with technology, how that will influence those generations. And will those people now not be used to texting? Maybe texting will be like, well, old people text. Like that's really old thing to do. Why are you doing that?
I think that's really likely. I remember when we landed in Mexico and there's a little kid in front of us and he was like, okay, Google, where are we?
Right. Yeah. I mean, so many good stories like that. Like I've seen young kids that are visiting new homes and they're like, Alexa, turn on the lights. Like the expectations like that. Or I've heard a story from a friend of mine who has a young kid and they were traveling and his daughter was saying to him, oh, I don't like this place because in the evening I'm really scared and I cannot turn on the lights from my bed.
Oh.
So like simple stuff like that. Yeah. But like that raises the bar in terms of expectations of what is possible. Mm-hmm. And it's quite exciting, actually. It's really quite exciting. Like from the eyes and ears and the experiences that we can see through young people, we can dream of the future world. And that's the stuff, frankly, that all of us around this table want to be investing in. We want to be inspired by people who can paint a very, very detailed picture of the future and get the emotions of greed and fear get going in us.
Yeah. What, so what other, outside of audio and voice, what other spaces are you excited about? There's today, Magic Leap just launched, and now you can buy for $2,200, I think it is, their Magic Leap device. So that's within sort of the AR kind of world. What other spaces are you excited about?
We're calling it Magic Baby Step.
Yeah, yeah.
Apparently the reviews of it, you know, it's the, I think it's the Clark quote that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And I think having read the reviews and I've seen a couple of leaps, it's not really a leap. It's more of a
little baby step
inch forward. I think AR and VR specifically have a long way to go before my college roommate or any normal person is spending a lot of time.
But things are getting better in the background quite a bit. And you can see that from the growing install base, not fast enough, and you can see it from engagement metrics and retention improving quite a bit. But it's going to take some time, as you said. And AR, you know, clearly we need some new hardware for it to become mainstream for everybody. But these are spaces to pay attention to because they are helping create new experiences that frankly you cannot see through some of the other form factors. Crypto offers some really, really interesting promise on the distribution front, and the incumbents don't know how to play it, and they're early on the learning curve as well. But other than, you know, raising money through token sales or speculations or value, you name it, they're not many other, you know, real use cases, especially on the consumer front. It's early days, but a lot of talent is going in. So inevitably, we are paying attention. When the top talent gets into a sector, as early stage VCs, you have to stop everything you're doing and pay attention, try to understand what's going on. So these are the two areas, you know, that I'm mostly spending time on and investing some early dollars on behalf of GC.
That's really the only way to invest as a generalist in early stage frontier companies or in early stage emerging platform companies. It's to make people bets. So of course, like, I'm also excited about blockchain and crypto because the smartest people are going into it. And you see a lot of ideas and companies that are half baked, but it's the brilliant, like, exceptional Jobs-esque founder that gets that can convince people of their vision and their bakedness and gets the money to eventually propel the company to that level. So you make a people bet because you think the person can tell a story well enough that they can, with that story, muster the resources that make their small idea a big reality.
Stick around to the end of this episode for a mini interview with Marian Wu, president of GE Ventures. We talked about how GE Ventures is investing in the future of startups. Starting a business is hard. Accepting money shouldn't be. That's why Product Hunt is built on Stripe. In the early days, before we had a real team or any funding, we spent way more time than anticipated trying to figure out how to collect payments from our customers. We cobbled together a bunch of different solutions, but the end result wasn't professional, our accounting was messy, and even worse, it was a terrible experience for our users. Then we switched to Stripe. Integration was easy, and we started collecting money from people around the world without janky redirects or a lot of friction. Today, we use Stripe to collect subscription revenue from makers and startups around the world using Ship. Their web dashboard makes it really easy for anyone on the team to create new SKUs or discounts for customers without writing a single line of code. Whether you're building a marketplace, a SaaS company, or a subscription product, Stripe makes it easier to get paid. They also make it easier to get started with Stripe Atlas. Founders all over the world can incorporate a new business, set up a bank account, and access everything they need to get running in just a few clicks. If you want to start a business and make money on the internet, check out stripe.com.
And Ryan, you know, the other couple of areas that are coming up and are interesting, we're seeing a resurrection in terms of social media, online communities get built. I'm like immensely thrilled about that because it's been, frankly, you know, like wandering a little bit in the Sahara Desert in that front the last few years.
But people have soured on Facebook. People are looking for different
people
ways
are looking. The big platforms are a little bit distracted. Gaming space is like happening front and center, like with Fortnite, with guys and girls and everybody being part of it. Like, I think it's opening up some interesting opportunities on the community social networking front. So I'm very thrilled about it and placing some early bets alongside you guys. And the other space is like unsexy areas. So like technology clearly is getting into every industry right now. So if you go and look into the Fortune 500 or even like any of the public listed companies that don't have software engineers working for them or they don't have any tech-enabled version of their product, everything is getting disrupted. Like you pick the industry, whatever you want, from staffing industry to property management to paint. End of life to
one
like
of my favorite companies
everything.
Is that it's like literally paint. It's like watching paint dry. It's called Claire. It's a direct-to-consumer paint company. It really simplifies the choosing a paint process. It sends you a bunch of chips, paint chips. And
as samples to... checking your home.
Checking your home.
Yeah. There's also this direct-to-consumer... It's almost like a meme now within the tech ecosystem. There's a lot more direct-to-consumer companies, and there's things that have changed that have enabled these independent creators to start a Shopify site and... you know, find distribution on Instagram or Facebook or whatnot. Are you excited about direct to consumer? As an investor, it doesn't have the same multiples as software companies, but
as a consumer, definitely. Yeah. As an investor, it's very hard to make the math work.
I'd agree with you. For me, you know, the question with direct to consumer brands is always what is the distribution advantage? So at the early stage, the founder should either be an extreme storyteller that you truly believe that she or he will build an incredible brand that people will care about. And there are several examples that we've seen over the years. Or secondly, have a founder who is an amazing growth hacker who understands how to acquire customers very cheaply, knows where growth pockets are right now. A lot of these companies, it used to be much easier to get started when Instagram was getting going or paid acquisition, Facebook was early. At DC, we've made a number of good bets in that space. Like, we're thrilled to be invested in Warby Parker and Outer Voices. These are companies, you know, that share some of, founders share some of the characteristics that I mentioned.
Yeah.
It's the exceptions. Like Emily Weiss from Glossier is definitely what Nico is describing as an amazing growth hacker who understands where the latencies are, the undiscovered pockets of consumers are, and then just, you know, goes and gets them.
But it's very hard, right? Like if you invest in a company 4 or 5 years in, may end up being, I don't know, hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue. And then for whatever reason, they stop growing or they need to start doing discounting to get more customers. They feel the pressure from the board that they need to grow faster. So they are doing all these unnatural acts, stops growing, or the unit level economics are not good. And then you're worth 1 to 2x revenue. So it's a hard space. That's yeah. not an easy one.
What's been an interesting trend, I think you mentioned Warby Parker earlier. Warby Parker was, their innovation was, you know, online distribution and making it really easy and low friction to try on glasses at home. And then, of course, as they've grown and expanded and tried to capture more of the market, they open up retail stores. And it's kind of funny to see how these online direct-to-consumer brands, how they started online, but then they naturally start to look more like incumbents in many ways, but still with the same brand and a lot of the DNA of like a startup and innovating. But again, they're going to brick and mortar, which isn't the sexy cool thing to do.
Well, it gives you prestige. So it is the sexy cool thing to do. Yeah. It does give you the sense of having arrived when you can go into the real store.
Yeah.
Or the Warby store, or even, doesn't Shopify sometimes have physical locations as well? Or the Glossier store.
Yeah. Or pop-ups in many different cases. We're seeing more of these companies do pop-ups.
That Casper Dreamland where you can go and fall asleep.
I think it's like a van, right? A portable thing?
No, I thought it was just a location in New York where you could pay. I'm not sure of whether it's a van or not a van, but I think it's like a big nap room where you can go pay some money and fall asleep for an hour in a Casper bed. Which is both, it's like brilliant from a revenue, an ancillary revenue stream standpoint, because people are paying you to get acquired as a customer.
You're paying for a product demo.
Yeah, but you have to be omnichannel, right? Like, and we've seen, you know, the power of social media and the power of the emerging online brands. So why not? It's just another way to reach your customer. It's another way to cultivate, as Alexia said, new customer segments. And in the case of Warby Parker, the stores are ridiculously profitable. Like the interesting decision point with some of these companies is like, oh, we can continue to do online, but offline is insanely profitable. Where do we double down on?
And I actually love tech companies that get you offline. Like, this is one of the reasons I love The Wing. Like, it's getting you off the internet into a physical place, interacting with most of the people that you'd follow on Twitter or on Instagram in real life. And there's really no replacement for that kind of human connection.
Yeah. For those that don't know The Wing, do you want to describe it?
It is it's a co-working space for women only. They're right now in New York and DC, but will be opening in San Francisco very soon, in LA probably very soon, in Paris. It just got announced today. And it's founded by a woman named Audrey Gelman. She's a super connector in New York. They've raised a ton of money. I think they've raised somewhere around 20 to 30 million. Kleiner Perkins, I think, is investing. Invested in WeWork actually invested, which is so smart.
Which is very, I was not expecting that.
I mean, it makes so much sense. Go to a WeWork. WeWorks are very masculine environments, and The Wing is the opposite. It's all pink. All the books are color coded. But when you go there, and it costs a lot of money to go there. I think they could do a better job of price points that are more inclusive. But when you go there, you really do see a diverse group of women from all walks of life, from every industry, from every sort of, you know, it's not just, you see women of color, it's not just the most privileged. It's a place where you take that kind of siloed online experience that you're getting with algorithms to just like reroute you to people that you know, and bring back a level of spontaneity and meeting people that don't necessarily, you know, hold your point of view. And I love it. I think more companies should think about how to get their users to get out and meet each other or take a walk. Like Pokemon Go, another great example of this. Like getting people into the world and interacting with each other in the world, I think should be more of a priority.
Venture capital firms. Like all the magic happens after you meet people and then you discuss about the businesses and the founders you met with your partners and others in the ecosystem and you make a decision, right?
Yeah, it's like a serendipity that has been increasingly lost online.
Yeah, I think Twitter is the like best serendipity machine. I think a lot of my relationships, my career, frankly, is reliant entirely on Twitter. Product Hunt wouldn't exist without Twitter. And that's how I met a lot of people initially. And it's this like machine which introduces you to people, and then you form relationships from that. And we don't really have that in, at least in San Francisco, for me personally, in my kind of circle of friends. We don't really have that beyond the occasional dinners or meetups or something that we might attend. We don't have there's no business or place to go hang out. Like, a WeWork is not, sorry, WeWork, I hope you're not, I hope we don't ever have to have you as a sponsor, but it's not a place to hang out with people or meet people. And yeah, we don't really have that right now, it feels like.
You could actually go to this Blue Bottle right here at 2 South Park and get somewhat of a sense of that. Like, when I go in there, there's usually one or two people that I know. South Park used to be this way. So you were asking earlier about how tech has changed in the time that we've been in tech. And so, someone yesterday was saying that they were asking for advice on being an investor in 2010. And I was like, the advice better have been go to South Park and shoot a dart. Like, go to South Park.
Invest in every single company around it. And you would have gotten a piece of what? Like, Instagram, would have gotten Uber. A piece of so many different companies. Yeah, it's insane. Yeah,
it's pretty incredible.
Or even, like, you know, just buy some of the real estate.
Yeah.
Go to South Park and buy the building that we're in right now.
Well, it's not that expensive, but I mean, in SF, the other places it's that not people like that go,
it's my point.
And you can meet people, like, is the Dolores Park over the weekend, right? Mm-hmm. Like, when the weather is nice, a ton of people are there, and it's a great place to hang out. And through friends, you get to meet others. The professional setting, yeah, I agree with you. Twitter, LinkedIn, maybe, are the only, you know, like, spots for you have a lot of serendipity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so let's talk about products you love or apps you love. Are there some maybe new additions to your home screen or things that you use at home that change your life or outside of your bionic machine, Alexia?
Yeah, so I'm definitely going to put a vote in for my harness, my Frida Kahlo corset here. It's definitely changed my life. Things that I use that have changed my life. I'm really into things that are saving me money right now. Like, when I was in the hospital for this thing last month, I somehow saved money and I looked into my bank account and I was like, you know why? Because I wasn't taking Uber and Lyft everywhere. And so, and it was something crazy. It was like $1,000-something in just transportation cost or more. And I finally realized why people want the scooters. I was like, okay, well, what if I just scooter everywhere? How much money can I save?
With your harness on. Is that doctor approved?
With my harness, definitely not.
Nico's freaking out. Like, don't do it.
More risk. Where if he sees Nico, we need to take risk. But I'm using a company called Truebill that alerts me at any point in my credit card history when something looks weird. So it alerted me that I had a fee for something the other day or that my phone bill was too high. And I love that because I'm a price-sensitive consumer. I like Moment, which is
first time I hear that.
Really?
I thought you were a price-sensitive investor, a consumer.
Both, but goes both ways. At Moment, which I just brought up, which tells you about your screen time. I'm really loving an app called WeCroak, which reminds you 5 times a day that you're going to die. Yeah. It's like a digital memento mori. I love that because nothing makes you spend your time better than a reminder that you don't have very much of it.
Yeah. I'm forgetting the name, but there was a product on product in a Chrome extension that every new tab has a countdown clock for the day that they expect you to die based on, you know, average like life expectancy and everything. Yeah, I haven't played with that myself. I don't know if I want that reminder every day.
No, it's not depressing. It actually makes you a better person. Like, you're much nicer to people when you think, hey, maybe this is the last time that I see them. Like, when you realize, and again, I had a recent event in my life that really put an emphasis on this. When you realize that nothing is really permanent, then you can stop taking everything so seriously.
I haven't used Moment, but we've seen Instagram, Facebook, and some other platforms now introduce similar types of features where you can see how much time you're spending on Instagram. Do you think the Instagram specifically, do you think that's a gimmick? Do you think it's them just building these features to appeal to the complaints around addiction and all the other concerns that are coming up? Or do you think it's actually useful?
Why would any company that's a public company that has a fiduciary duty to shareholders want people to spend less time using their product. Right, it's lip service. Yeah.
That's a challenge, I think, with all these companies. Like, the social media companies are designed around advertising-based businesses, which are reliant on eyeballs, going back to the attention piece. Kind of makes me wonder also in the future, when we do start to consume audio more often, what is that? How are they going to monetize that? The biggest
imagine how annoying the audio ads could be. Like, you wear the AirPods forever. Like, whoever, you know, pitches like me an ad network for voice, I'm going to be like, you know what? I don't want this in my life.
Maybe we need to rethink the ad model entirely. So I'm actually excited about media companies that are trying to figure out a better way of being and supporting themselves. Unfortunately, there's not very many. I shout out to Medium because they're trying, but there hasn't been anything that's come about that replaces display that isn't also hugely annoying, like a pre-roll on a video. So maybe the onus is on the ad tech companies to come up with a better plan, because this page view eyeball plan has resulted in a lot of really, really bad stuff. And it is also kind of like a threat to democracy in many ways.
Yeah, I see both sides of it. On one side, I think advertising is amazing and awesome, because imagine if we didn't have ads. One, we wouldn't have the networks and the companies that exist today, and also it would make the internet less accessible, because
yeah, we'd have to pay for everything.
Yeah, it would suck. And so ads generally are great. I think, you know, it comes with its own negative aspects too, and that's kind of the balance, I think, is we have to figure out like what the right balance is between ad based models and privacy and all those things, and hopefully also add new ways of making revenue. Like, I think Substack is interesting. If you've looked at them, have you played with?
Yeah, they're doing a good job. Yeah, it is indeed, you know, like interesting and how they're helping, you know, all these different players monetize. Mm-hmm. It is interesting. But back to the commentary, you know, like on audio ads, like I've seen over the last few months, so many companies that are really good at impersonating people or notable, you know, like folks, celebrities, or I've seen folks that can help you sing. Yeah, deep fakes can help you automatically sing a new song with your own voice that was just composed on the fly for you, stuff like that. I mean, imagine, you know, like listening to ads every day from your favorite celebrities or podcasts,
or even maybe your friends. Maybe it's Alexia's voice telling an ad in your ear. I mean, that could be possible. They're going to use this podcast.
Hyper targeting, right?
Yeah. They'll get a good sample of your voice with this podcast. So,
Nico selling me a corset or a selfie stick, or
to be honest, I think it'd be kind of fun. It'd be kind of cool. I mean, if you're going to get an ad, might as well make it fun and make it something enjoyable. And you know, having Nico's voice in my ear might be more fun than some random person. So
I'm just down for ads that don't reward like controversy and negativity bias. I think as humans, we have a negativity bias. We like bad news. We like controversial news. We like salacious news. And so anything that rewards volume over quality is going to incentivize a lot of bad behavior.
Yeah, but the future is going to be really, really interesting in that regard, right? If everything starts looking insanely familiar, because it's really, really, really easy to copy and reproduce everything that's familiar for all of us. I mean, it's going to be insane.
I mean, but this is the promise of the blockchain, non-fungible goods. This is the promise. The internet broke most creative industries because all of a sudden you can make infinite copies of anything. So with the blockchain, you can actually create a good that is one and done, one and only, and not infinitely reproducible.
For me, the most interesting point about that is that a lot of the crypto companies, the entities that help create these products may cease to exist because they may go bankrupt or whatever. But these products, to your point, will live forever. Yeah. So it's one of these few
Genesis
cases.
Genesis Cat is eternal.
Yeah. It's one of these, you know, few cases, like, you know, visiting Greece and you see the ruins, you know, from folks who built it like 2,000-3,000 years ago. Same here, you know, we're going to have all these digital artifacts that are going to outlive the creators or the entities behind them. It's like insane. Mm-hmm.
There was this actually wasn't on the blockchain, but related to what you're describing. Yesterday, somebody posted an app around or a service where you could buy fractional ownership in a racing horse. And for $100, you can own part of Moonlight Sky, this beast of a horse. And I find that interesting. It also aligns with a trend I've noticed where I think it's called Arthena is doing that for art. It's a YC-backed company where you can buy fractional ownership of art.
I've seen this unlock fractional ownership of subscriptions.
Yeah, you can do it for real estate. You can do it for many, many things. What does the horse think?
Yeah, how do you get a return on the horse?
I don't know if there's actually... I don't know.
ROH,
I
haven't looked into it. Yeah. Return on horse.
I just found it fascinating. At first, it seems kind of silly, and then it makes sense. There's a whole audience and community around racehorses that, of course, would love to be kind of an owner in some capacity, but they can't afford... I don't know how much horse. I don't know how much a horse costs, but probably more than $100.
Part of the tail, you have something. And then all the owners once a year show up to meet and greet the horse, and the horse is confused.
It's like the $1 million homepage for horses. Remember that site? Yeah. Yeah. Pay per pixel event. Yeah. Paper. Yeah. So I think there's really interesting. Rally Road is another example of classic cars. You can buy a part of like a 1969 Porsche, and it's partly for fun and kind of like a community activity, but also like as an investment. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, this can work with collectibles that are scarce assets, and during the good times, or, you know, if collectively people think that these assets over time appreciate in value, this could work out, you know? People have been making money from owning art and other scarce assets for a long time. I have friends of mine who are doing it with watches. There are companies that are helping service this community and this passion. It's like really interesting.
Yeah. I'm curious what your answer to the question is. You probably see more products than everyone in South Park combined. Now that you're investing, it's probably exponentially increased. What are you excited about? What products are on your homepage or in your AirPods or in your real life outside on the street?
On the street. I'm interested in a lot of the spaces that we've talked about with regards to audio and voice, and I am following blockchain crypto, but not making as many bets there at this time. I'm more excited as a consumer. There's one app that I'm playing with recently that hasn't been talked about too much that I'm curious if you heard of. It's called October. Have you heard of it? Okay. And so it actually goes back to kind of Secret. Secret was this app that I think most people probably in technology remember, which was an anonymous-based app to share your thoughts, kind of like if Twitter was entirely anonymous. And it grew very, very quickly, but suffered from a lot of like trolling and a lot of negativity. And October is a new app that, to me, is in that same world. I think what's fascinating about that space is social media, it's become challenging to speak honestly and truthfully because you have, you know, your name associated with everything, and you have a brand to kind of keep up, and you also have people that rely on you. And so your words, like my words, affect Product Hunt potentially if I say the wrong thing. And so there isn't a place to kind of speak freely, I think, online as much as there could be. And we've also moved to a world where we used to be actually very pseudonym based. Like I used to go by Ultimate Zero was my like video game tag on like Battle.net and all these other platforms, IRC, and it wasn't my real name.
Discord handle too, right?
It Discord wasn't around back then, unfortunately. Otherwise, I would have been a heavy Discord user. And I used to use that pseudonym, that username online. And then over time, as Facebook became more popular and it became more acceptable to use your real name.
And you became Ryan Hoover.
I became Ryan Hoover. Yeah, I transformed into Ultimate Zero to Ryan Hoover. And I think that's an interesting trend. And as a result, it's changed, I think, the way that people communicate online. And so going back to October is an app that looks very similar to Twitter. It's super early right now, but it looks similar to Twitter in that it's a feed of people that you follow. And the big difference between Twitter is you can tweet under your own real name if you want, or you can tweet essentially anonymously. And the conversation, you can reply to a conversation in your own name or anonymously. And of course, there's a lot of potential risks and challenges with that. But I find that attempt interesting because it can potentially, if you took Twitter and added that feature overnight, it'd be really interesting to see how that would change the dynamics, both in the negative, but maybe the positive. And so I don't know, that's a space that I'm curious to explore just as a consumer, but very cautious to invest in for a number of reasons. I don't want it to become a negative place either. Like, I don't want it to have a net negative effect on the world. But I think there's a lot of positive that can come from the right product in that space.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, like if you can do a great job with the community management and make sure that everybody can follow the same norms, it could be really interesting. I mean, the internet got started like that in the beginning. Everything was anonymous, or people were using nicknames, right? Yeah. So if we can bring back some of the good parts of that, not the ugly parts of that, especially now that the whole internet is a lot more diverse, a ton more voices, could be interesting. Challenges or quite a few. And as we've seen in many, many, many attempts, if things are going south and you can't fix them in the very beginning, there's no way back.
But I agree with you. I think there's something to be said for reconceptualizing the concept of identity online, because it's like a fluke that Facebook owns who we are. It's a fluke. It was a hole in the market that Facebook filled, and we could have just easily had some sort of identity protocol like we have IMAP and POP for email. It's a complete accident, and it has ended up probably costing us more than it's benefited us, in my personal opinion. And so I think there's an opportunity for something to come along and do it right. But should that be a big monopolistic company? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
It should be a decentralized company then.
Decentralized.
That's what they
hope. Word of the year.
By the community.
Yeah. Cool. Well, thanks for coming on. Thanks for having me over at GC as well. Even though you have all this construction.
Thank you for hosting us today. You're the host.
Oh, yeah. All right. Cool.
We have a lot of construction. We're built because we're helping build the great companies of the future.
There we go.
We're a work in progress.
Do you have any portfolio companies or anything to plug, anything to mention? Where can they find you?
Companies that save money. I love my portfolio company, Omni. Whenever I'm having an event and I don't have enough chairs, you can always get chairs on Omni. You can rent them here in SF from a lot of really illustrious luminary venture capitalists. So if you're an entrepreneur and you need a chair and you also want to build a relationship with a Valley VC, go on Omni. There are, I think, you know, our chairs might be on there. I don't know. But yes, Omni for venture capital chairs.
Perfect.
And they would mention, thank you for giving us this opportunity because we love promoting our portfolio.
Yeah, please, we could do this for 4 more hours.
We'll do round two, just all self-promotion.
Exactly. VCs love talking about themselves and the portfolio companies, right? So the one I would mention, since the audience is a lot of tech founders or aspiring founders, is Atrium, which Atrium is probably the best legal partner for every single one of them because it offers them legal services with predictable costs and super high quality legal advice.
Yeah, but they're tackling a massive market that's super, super fraction. I mean, no one owns the market. It's a bunch of legal firms.
No one owns the market. Business model is challenged and, for higher quality service right now.
Yeah, cool. Thanks for coming on.
Now's the part of the show where we hear from you, the listeners. We asked the Product Hunt community, what's your favorite home screen app that few people know about? Here are a few of the responses.
Please leave a message after the tone.
Hi, it's Edwin. I'm from San Francisco. Favorite home screen app is Transit. It shows an aggregation of all of the public transportation around you, including dockless bikes and scooters.
Hey, Ryan. It's Dan from Toronto. I wanted to include an app that I've used for quite a while called Nuzzle, and it's an aggregation service based off Twitter and goes through your feed and personalizes this news update for you every single day. And it's solved the problem for me since I have a lot of people I'm following on Twitter and don't have a lot of time to go through the feed in a chronological order. So I love that it's able to generate a list of the articles that would be important to me based off who's sharing in my network and can just serve those to me every day.
Hi, Ryan. This is Randy Berry. I'm calling from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. I'm calling because I'm sure that a lot of people do have this app, but I was just thinking about it last night. Sleep Cycle is an app that I've been using since 2010, back when it used movement, and over time it's developed into using sound and recording while you sleep. They actually throw away all of the stuff that they record, so it's really good for privacy and also really helps me wake up feeling refreshed. It's an awesome app.
If you'd like to share your favorite apps on the show, give us a call at 707-785-6152.
Hi, Marian. Thanks for joining us on Product Hunt Radio, and thanks to GE Ventures for making this possible. GE Ventures is investing in the new industrial revolution, and that means Marianne works with all kinds of startups solving under-the-radar business problems.
First off, tell us a little bit more about what you're doing at GE.
I lead the investing team at GE Ventures. It's a really exciting role where we invest in leading startups and we build a bridge back between those startups to GE to help GE be more innovative.
Is there a particular space or industry that you're really excited about to invest in?
So if you think about what's happened in the last 10 years, we've completely revolutionized commerce, media, communications, finance. But if you look at more physical or operational industries, they're barely touched by technology. So there's massive opportunities to bring that same capability into these more traditional industries.
There's a sort of theme around the unsexy industries.
They're tough industries that have certain dynamics around them. Regulatory, for example, they have incumbency effects. So it's hard for a brand new entrepreneur to penetrate those industries. That's again how a big company like GE can partner with small companies. We can bring that industry expertise. We can certainly bring credibility. We can bring channels and other support that can help those companies be successful in these industries that are harder to penetrate.
Thanks again, GE Ventures, for making this interview possible. GE Ventures invests in startups that develop transformational technologies to solve big problems. Visit ge.com/ventures to learn more.
Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next week. But in the meantime, share the podcast with your friends on Twitter and tag a guest you'd like to hear in a future episode. See you soon.